I want to thank, I want to begin by thanking people for joining us today. We do this, we try to do about, 12 or 15 of these webinars every year. I wish I could do it with every single Sapir author. There's so many fabulous essays that we just don't have the time or bandwidth to have a webinar to deal with in a webinar. But your piece with Masuha Sagiv and its interesting pairing, I think, with Avi Schick's piece coming from a different place, I thought was going to make for a really wonderful conversation. And someone is reminding me here. One second. Where is this? There's an announcement I need to make, and I'd better make it, or my friends at the Maimonides Fund will banish me for all time. So I don't want that to happen. Yes, okay. There are upcoming events. So while we're waiting for Avi, I just want to mention them. The next one is we've titled A Red Pen Response to Anti-Semitism. How should we contend with anti-Semites in literature, online, and beyond? Also a conversation bringing together two very different perspectives, one from Jonathan Greenblatt, of course, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, and then from my friend and Maimonides Fund fellow and bestselling author, Jamie Kirchick, two other really exemplary pieces in the current issue. And then the second announcement that I need to make is to tell listeners to click the link in the chat or go to sapirjournal.org to sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know about upcoming events. Okay, now I've gotten the homework out of the way. I don't want to wait for Avi to figure out his technical issues. I'm sure he's going to come on board very soon. But I really wanted to, you wrote really a very powerful and very subtle essay with Masuha Sagiv, Dalia. And so I just wanted to, first of all, kind of set the stage. And really that stage was set 6 summers ago with the horrific, almost exactly 6 summers ago, the horrific neo-Nazi march on Charlottesville, or through Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally, which garnered global attention. And then something else happened in Charlottesville, which didn't garner so much attention. A lawsuit that was very thoughtfully constructed. So take us through just what happened and the significance you attach to it, both in terms of the litigation, but also in terms of thinking about the position of American Jews in a moment of both great success and also great vulnerability.
So I just want to say thanks to Brett, to Sapir, to Felicia. It's a treat to be in conversation. And it's great to be with you, Avi. I learn from you every time we speak. I think probably the short and most intimate answer to the question is, you know, Charlottesville was a signal moment for me because I had lived there. For 18 years, that was my synagogue. Those were my neighbors, those monuments, the Civil War monuments that became the sort of touchstone of all the controversy, quite literally were the place around my shul where my kids learned to walk and crawl. So it was incredibly personal, the Unite the Right rally. And I think it was, for me, an incredibly emblematic moment that pulled together a lot of themes I had been struggling with, both as a legal thinker, as a First Amendment thinker, as a religious liberty thinker. A lot was packed into those few days in the summer of the Unite the Right rally. And maybe the only other thing I would say is that I was a scholar in residence at Hartman with Masuha, and we were learning together and teaching together. And I was teaching the trial that you described, which was the civil trial rooted in, you know, a KKK statute from Reconstruction, in which Robbie Kaplan, one of the lawyers who I actually describe in my book, who flew down to Charlottesville 3 days after the Unite the Right rally and started finding plaintiffs, that trial also was a really consequential kind of signature moment in how we as Jews respond to anti-Semitism in America. So really a lot packed into that. And Masua, on the other hand, who comes at the justice system from the vantage of being educated and having taught in Israel, and I both found that we were mirroring each other in our reflections and concerns on how we think about these issues of anti-Semitism, of power, and of vulnerability. And we ended up kind of marrying our two ways of thinking about how do you hold the notion, the irreconcilable notion of being both powerful as Jews and also deeply vulnerable as Jews. How do we hold that tension, both in terms of what was happening to the Jewish community in Charlottesville and subsequently around the country, as we're seeing, you know, attacks on Jews mount, but also how do we hold it in terms of what's happening in Israel, that tension between being utterly powerful, utterly vulnerable at the same instant, and having to deflect critiques of both those realities. And so I think in some sense, and this is a long-winded answer, Brett, the piece attempted to say that if we in North America could align ourselves with that tension as it exists among our friends and cousins in Israel and sit in the duality between power and vulnerability and their power and vulnerability, this kind of burgeoning rift between how we think about ourselves as Jews in North America and how Jews in Israel think about themselves as Jews might at minimum have a channel open. And so that was the effort. And I just also want to stipulate the piece raises vastly more questions than it answers, but at least as a paradigm for how I wanted to think about that lawsuit in Charlottesville and the national response, or as you say, lack of response to that lawsuit in Charlottesville, it's a jumping off point for a much deeper conversation about how we navigate that tension.
One of the points that I think both you and Avi bring up is not just the question of power, but perceptions of power. And Avi, I wanted to turn to you because you come from a community of Orthodox Jews in New York to whom of whom it is often said, well, it's a vastly powerful group of people, right? You quote a former mayor of New York, I think it was Mike Bloomberg, saying, I'm the first mayor to stand up, you know, on the subject of a certain form of ritual circumcision to 10,000 black-hatted people, you know, banging at your door. And so, Avi, I'd like you to reflect on this question about the gap between the perception of power regarding the ultra-Orthodox community, particularly in New York City and New York State, and the reality that you experience as a community that is not only vulnerable to everyday attacks in the streets, but as you, I think, fascinatingly point out, a series of legal challenges that haven't been mounted against any other community, as far as I know, at least not in New York.
Well, thank you, Brett, for having me contribute, inviting me to contribute to the issue of Sapir, which was wonderful, and for today. And Dahlia, good to see you again. If I have a little burgeoning op-ed career, part of it is due to Dahlia, who was my editor numerous times at Slate, and if those pieces were good, it reflects lots of her assistance and input. So in New York, right, there is this perception, as you say, Brett, of a very powerful Orthodox community. We're identifiable, right? You know, you walk in the street, you're wearing a yarmulke, something else, and so they're visible. And I think, you know, there's a convergence. I think, you know, some of the community like to play off the perception of there being power. right? Because some people like to say they're powerful, or they think perception leads to reality. And of course, those who want to undermine the community use that perception of power, right? And because what they do is they say, you know, the only reason this or that exists until this point, right, is because they're powerful. The only reason to really listen to their complaint about what's going on is because they're powerful. They use the power to actually undermine, you know, the validity of their arguments. They call it, right, they're frequently or more than frequently referred to in the media, right, as a voting bloc. Now, you know, put aside the, you know, the how you can use that about any group. I mean, I guess in politics, right, you know, you try to get like-minded people together who vote. But you know, nobody describes a group they agree with as a voting bloc. No one says, you know that, you know, rights of this other group, you know, were advanced because, you know, a group of voters got together. The perception of the voting bloc is used to say there's no validity to the argument. There's no moral strength to the argument. There's nothing, you know, to the argument other than a bunch of Jews who have power that they shouldn't have. And so it's used against them. And as I tried to lay out in the article, we're talking about a series of issues over a decade's time, where it's not only that, you know, traditions at the core of Jewish practice, whether it's circumcision, it's prayer, it's Jewish education, come under attack by government. But in each instance, the elected official who was leading the attack, you know, congratulated himself on having the courage to stand up to the Jews. And in each instance, right, that, you know, the courts, you know, came down on our side and pointed out that there was a double standard, right? That you know, whatever the argument the government is making, you know, they don't seem to apply it evenly, whether it's in circumcision, whether it's in the Houses of Worship case against Cuomo. And so it really, you know, I think it has implications for how we think about Jewish power, I guess. But more importantly, I think it has, you know, real implications for, you know, the Jewish community, right? If our core rituals, if things that are really at the core of Orthodox Jewish existence, you know, the ability to pray, the ability to educate our children, the ability, you know, to you know, raise them in a certain tradition, which of course includes circumcision. If those are vulnerable in New York, that sends a very dangerous message to where we're headed.
There was a particularly redolent phrase, Avi, in your essay that I want to quote back to you, because I just want you to unpack it a little bit for us. You say, "Let me be clear. I don't believe that New York's mayors and governors are anti-Semites, but the New York we inhabit at the moment reflects the convergence of the nanny state and the secular state." Give us a few more sentences about what you mean by that.
Sure. So, you know, we're at a time where religion doesn't have a whole lot of respect in New York. Certainly religious rituals, you know, rituals that are different from the mainstream. And so you have a government that, you know, doesn't see value in religion. And at the same time, what I refer to as that's the secular state. And what the nanny state is, right, is a government that, you know, is not inclined to say, you know, a parent knows best, you know, for his or her child. The government, you know, increasingly believes in every area that the government knows best. And when you put those two things together, you know, a government that, you know, increasingly gets involved in every area of life and has no inclination to defer to a parent, and a government that doesn't see any value in religion, you know, this is where you end up. And, you know, just if I can, you know, just give an example or two to explain what I mean. I mean, in almost every area, it's not that you know we're all University of Chicagoans today in government, but there's always some implicit cost benefit analysis, right? You know, if you think about the pandemic restrictions, right, certain businesses had to be open from the beginning because people have to get food, certain people have to be able to work and whatnot, and it's understandable. Now, when you come to you know, religious ritual, where, you know, many see it as purely spiritual, so it is hard for government to sort of say, well, what's the value in that? And if there's no value in it, right, then we, all we see is the danger. I wrote an article back when the circumcision restrictions came in that pointed out that the same year that the city adopted the regulations regarding circumcision, there was also an attempt to impose regulations requiring you know, adults even to wear helmets while bicycling. And there were about 20 deaths a year in New York as a result of bicycle accidents. And the city opposed those regulations. And the reason was because, regulating it and imposing a helmet requirement sends the message that this is an activity that's dangerous. And sending a message that an activity is dangerous, right, lowers the prevalence of it, right? Some people are not going to undertake that activity because it's dangerous. And so New York City says, well, we don't want regulation of bicycle riding because we want more bicycle riding. Well, you know, they didn't bring that same sort of thinking to circumcision because they didn't care if there's more circumcision or less circumcision. And so, you know, during the pandemic, and again, I don't want to get into this too deeply, but there were some lawsuits and there was a lot written about the fact that, you know, there were criticisms of some kind of gatherings and government, you know, chose in New York and elsewhere not to criticize gatherings that arose, I guess, spontaneously and then not after the murder of George Floyd. Because, you know, there was some value, they thought, to those kind of gatherings and those kind of protests and other kind of gatherings. They said, well, we don't see it as much. And so when you have a government that makes those cost benefit analysis and trade-offs, you know, what happens if we have this activity or not, and the government puts zero value on parents, you know, prerogative, and zero value, you know, to what religion brings to the table, this is where you end up. And just one last point, in 2019, when we argued the first of the education cases, the Assistant Attorney General representing the state got up in Albany Supreme Court. And the first thing he said was, we're here today to discuss what happens when parents conscript their children, you know, to religious schools. Now, the notion of talking about a parental choice, you know, of religious education, to talk about that as conscription, where we all think of that as like some, you know, forcible rule to go to the army or else there, it's just, you know, if the state sees parents choosing the type of schooling their kids want as conscription, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have the problems that we have.
I want to come back to some of these themes that you raised, Avi, and I want to say a number of readers took sharp issue with your essay, and I believe in the value of making sure these differences are aired. So I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But Dalia, I want to go back to your essay and the way I want to ask you about the way in which the lawsuit was organized and conceived, in which, if my understanding is correct, there wasn't a single Jewish plaintiff, even though both the lawyers arguing the cases as well as the philanthropists supporting the cases were overwhelmingly or broadly Jewish. And this has something to do with the question of how do Jews best advance their security in a society where they are at risk, but not the only people at risk, maybe not even the main people at risk. How do we conceive of advancing our interests in a way that extends beyond the narrow remit of, or the narrower remit of sort of an exclusively Jewish concerns?
Let me answer that and maybe link it up to something Avi just said about how we think about Jewish power and the perception of Jewish power. One of the things I'd been studying a lot at Hartman with my colleague there, Avi Helfand, the other Avi, is this issue of amicus briefs at the Supreme Court. For many, many years, when Jewish groups filed an amicus brief is essentially technically a friend of the court brief, but it comes from some outside interested party who has some investment in the outcome of the litigation, and separate out the sort of Amicus Industrial Complex, which is now that, you know, big cases at the court have hundreds and hundreds of briefs from many organizations. But historically, Jews and Jewish groups tended to file only on one side, and that tended to be the liberal side. And it tended to be Jewish organizations, sort of the ones that you would think of, who were typically filing on the side of whatever the progressive values were. And we've seen a huge uptick in recent years, in the very recent past, of Orthodox Jewish groups filing amicus briefs at the Supreme Court, often in tension with the progressive Jewish groups. And so we have seen the advent of Orthodox amicus briefs on issues like Dobbs, the abortion case, on multiple issues, many, many issues having to do with church-state delineations. And there is this question of, is it good for the Jews to be on both sides of really seminal constitutional and statutory questions? And I think partly my answer to what Avi is raising in the question you're asking is, it's always good for the Jews to be on both sides, in much the same way that we now have Jews deeply, deeply invested on opposite political sides of the spectrum, which is also quite new. And so I think what I want to say is the definition in some sense of power is the power and freedom in America to disagree with each other and to not care that much that it looks like it's bad for the Jews, you know, that we're intramural bickering amongst themselves, that in the end of the day, it's an incredibly important development that we disagree on really fundamental and foundational issues of statutory and constitutional law. And I raise it as a way of saying that I think you're really only free when you can be on both sides of issues in some sense without regard for what people are saying about the Jews and who they're in the tank for. And I just want to sort of say that as a way of knitting together your question and Avi's last reflections. And then I think that dovetails really nicely with my answer about what happened in Charlottesville, which is that a really deeply Jewish law firm, Kaplan and Hecker, mostly only Jewish litigators came down and tried the case. And as you say, there were no Jewish plaintiffs in the case.
By design.
Not by design. There was one Jewish plaintiff who was initially in the class of plaintiffs who was found by the judge not to have material interests that were harmed. So we had a group of largely Black and minority plaintiffs who were harmed in either the events the night before the rally on the UVA grounds or at the rally itself. And we had a bunch of Jewish lawyers. And the Jewish lawyers made a really deliberate choice. And again, I think this goes to something you're asking about what it is to be free as Jews in America, to not center only the anti-Semitism, but to center both stories, the story of the anti-Black animus, the anti-Latina, the anti-LGBTQ animus of these protesters, but also to tell the story of anti-Semitism in America. And I want to be really clear that a lot of those jurors did not know anything about the history of anti-Semitism in America. And in some sense, the case was a mirror image of what we saw in the 1960s when we had Dr. King and Heschel marching together saying, you know, we are both victims here. We had a town that was so riven by this fight about whether Charlottesville was anti-Semitism or anti-Black, anti-immigrant, anti-minority animus, that we never quite figured it out. To me, what was really essential about the story told in the trial was that it was an attempt to almost get back to that question of, we don't have to have a zero-sum conversation about whether they were Nazis or whether they were anti-Semites or whether they were Klansmen. We don't have to have a conversation about whether the events of August 2017 were fundamentally an attack on a tiny Jewish community and a bunch of Nazis chanting blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, or an attack on a Black community around historically post-Reconstruction monuments. It's both. And maybe the last thing I'll say is that we link to it in our piece, but I thought the most important text of that trial was the testimony of Deborah Lipstadt, who at great, great length explained that you cannot understand the history of anti-Semitism in America without understanding the history of anti-Black violence in America, and vice versa. And melded together in her testimony, all the ways in which we have to think about these issues of power and vulnerability again, that there were Jews who absolutely thrived when Black merchants were kicked out of the Vinegar Hill neighborhood in the 1920s and Jewish merchants came in. They were powerful and also horrific victims of anti-Semitism, that it's both, and we have to talk about it as both. And this, what they call in the office, the Olympics of suffering, in which we fight about whether they were Nazis or whether they were Klansmen, is an absolutely fruitless enterprise.
One of the point that you are in a sense raising, Dahlia, is sometimes goes under the term allyship, which probably most of our viewers are familiar with. It's certainly ones that my kids are familiar with. People talk about the importance of allies, and it tends to be a term that you hear most often in fairly progressive circles. But I wanted to turn this to Avi and ask him about his experience of a different kind of allyship. I mean, when the suit that ultimately overturned the injunction about religious gatherings, you know, that former Governor Cuomo had instituted, it was not just Orthodox synagogues, it was Roman Catholic dioceses that were part of that suit. So Avi, you know, the Orthodox community, I think, is experiencing a historic, maybe not unprecedented, because I think back to the Crown Heights riots, but certainly a historic tide of anti-Semitism. Are you experiencing, or are you gaining a sense of allyship when it comes to fundamental issues of religious liberty that connect you to, say, evangelical communities or other kinds of faith-based communities that feel they're under a similar kind of assault from, as you put it, the secular and the nanny state?
Sure. And so the answer is we certainly do, and we, you know, try to always, you know, reach out to those who are similarly situated or might be sympathetic. Going back, you know, to the lawsuit on the education issue in 2019, and it's written about as a Jewish issue. But in 2019, there were, you know, three different sets of plaintiffs. There were the Jewish schools, but then there were also the Council of Catholic School Superintendents and Catholic schools who challenged the regulations. And there were the New York State Association of Independent Schools, right? You know, each of which saw it as an attack, you know, on their ability to carry out the mission. The independent schools wasn't about the religious part, but it was about setting their own, you know, mission, philosophy, and educationally. You know, and then, you know, interestingly, because I was at the question takes me somewhere I wanted to go, which is, you know, when we sued Governor Cuomo, and you're correct, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn sued as well. And I think they felt they were unfairly caught up in this action that was targeted to the Orthodox community just because of some geographic issues. But what was most powerful is when we got to the Second Circuit, the Muslim Public Affairs Council submitted an amicus brief. And what they wrote in the introduction, I just want to quote, you know, two sentences because it resonates. It resonated then, and I think it still resonated, you know, when one thinks about the different communities and how Governor Cuomo brought them together. But what the Muslim Public Affairs Council wrote to the court is this. The stake of this court's rulings are high. In New York today, hate crimes against Jewish Americans are at their highest level since 1992. The government's accusatory rhetoric is fanning the flames of an already precarious position for New York's Orthodox Jews. And this irresponsible behavior can have deadly consequences. This court should strike down government policies that are rooted in and encourage such dangerous religious hostility. The First Amendment demands nothing less. And you know, that when I remember, I have this clear memory of when that brief came in and reading it. And it was obviously powerful in its own right. But the sort of the courage, the encouragement that it gave us, and you know, the feeling of, you know, others get it, right? They're not under attack in New York, and for the Muslim community to come up out so publicly, excuse me, in defense of the Orthodox community was a wonderful moment, and surely was helpful in, I think, opening eyes in the various courts that looked at our case and saying this is not just about, you know, this one community, and it's not just, you know, a bunch of powerful Jews who are complaining. It really goes to fundamental issues.
By the way, I'm soon going to turn to questions from the audience because I want to be sure they participate. And I see some of these questions that are already filling the Q&A function are probably going to be more appropriate for future webinars. For instance, there's a question about the ADL's attack or the case with Elon Musk. I'm having Jonathan Greenblatt on fairly soon, so I'm going to reserve questions like that. Let's make sure the questions speak to the conversation we're having. But you raised something, Avi, that jogs my mind with a point that is inscribed in your piece, Dahlia, and it's something that I'd like you to help me think through, which is the extent to which the Jewish community needs to exercise power without feeding perceptions of power, if you see what I'm saying, which is that we have achieved positions of real influence, authority, respect in the United States, and we haven't even touched the question of Israel and the Middle East. But Jews, secular or religious, know that one of the touchstones of anti-Semitic rhetoric, and Dahlia, you mentioned this in your pieces, the perception of the powerful Jew, Deborah Lipstadt touches on this, is what often feeds anti-Semitism. So before we go to the questions from our audience, think through this issue of how do we navigate our use of our power or the means at our disposal to shape outcomes that are better for the Jewish community, but not do it in a way that actually feeds the very problem that we're trying to address.
At the risk of speaking to exactly the subject you just told us not to speak to, it does feel that that is the beating heart of the current controversy between the ADL and Twitter, right?
Okay, by all means, I'm happy to stand up.
The actor formerly known as Twitter, and I think the answer is when you are making claims, as Mr. Musk has, that, you know, the ADL is single-handedly responsible for what, a 60%, you know, reduction in advertising. That's a claim rooted in stereotypes about powerful Jews, exactly what Avi raises in his piece, right? And so I think you're exactly correct that the challenge here in this conversation, and I do think it's the one that North American Jews and by exponential leaps and bounds Israeli Jews haven't really grappled with, which is what do we do with this perception that we are out of proportion to our numbers and our influence, very powerful, and yet not nearly as powerful as the world believes. And this is a question that goes back through the ages. And I think it's one we have to take very seriously. And I think the answer to your sort of animating question is we have to really understand. And this was, again, why I wrote about the Charlottesville trial and why I obsessively covered it. Is that at one level, when you have a Jewish law firm helicopter into a tiny town that has one synagogue, most of the residents of Charlottesville never knew what the threats that were made to the synagogue, never heard the story about how there was one Holocaust scroll that had to be spirited out in the middle of the night because there was no way to protect it, or that the police didn't show up to protect the synagogue, or that there was literally no support for this community, because the town saw this as an attack principally on Blacks as a result of Confederate statues and a Unite the Right rally that's sort of anti-Semitic curious, but really deeply racist. And so I think that the obligation has to be, unsurprisingly, we use our power, which is in this case vast, right? This amazing appellate law firm that sends its resources and raises tons and tons of Jewish money to try to bring about justice for everyone, not just the Jews. And maybe the last thing I'll say, and I don't know if this answers your question or raises new ones, was fascinating to watch the judge in the trial who would not let the N-word be uttered, right? Many, many of the Nazis and anti-Semites represented themselves, were pro se defendants, and happily spouted just awful, shocking things. Judge Moon did not allow them to say the N-word. He stopped it every time. Right up until the closing arguments, the K-word was dropped time again without interference by the judge. No problem using anti-Semitic slurs. So we're in a very weird, and for me, that is really representative of both the asymmetry in our sensitivity to anti-Semitism, but also the deep, deep commitment of these Jewish lawyers who just sat there and understood that this trial was about both and had to be made about both. And even in the face of a jury, most of whom did not know about the Holocaust, didn't really see how it was connected, to do some educating about how it's about both. And I think, I know it sounds aspirational, but I think in the end, to me, that was the achievement of that trial. And that's the thing I think we have to keep modeling going forward.
Okay.
Can I jump in for one minute?
Go ahead, just briefly though, because I do want to give our audience time.
I just want to say from the perspective here in New York, I mean, surely there are, from time to time, a self-inflicted wound, but just to ask the question, right, that you were just discussing, which is to say, you know, how can Jews, you know, make sure that you know, they don't want to foul the perception of power, right, is to acknowledge the power, enduring power of anti-Semitism, right, of no other community do you ask, you know, how do you make sure that, you don't step over some invisible line that's going to get, you know, the some you know, forces arrayed against you. And so, you know, there's, and whatever the Jewish community can do about, you know, how it presents on certain issues, pales in comparison, really, to what, you know, the class of the media and elected officials are going to do. You know, I'm sure people do and say stupid things from time to time in the Jewish community, but really, it's much more about the media having a hyper focus on the issue and elected officials feeling safe to raise it, I think, than it is about, you know, crossing some invisible boundary.
Okay, I'm going to turn to questions from the audience. Avi, by the way, we received through email a whole series of questions about your piece, but they're not here on the Q&A. So I will forward you those questions, but I'm only going to ask questions that actually, you know, people who showed up to this event want to ask. That being said, I'm going to ask you the hard question first, because an anonymous attendee says, I find Avishik's comments regarding restrictions on ritual circumcision and religious education to be completely disingenuous. No one has sought to restrict either of these. The circumcision issue has to do with an unsanitary practice used by some ultra-Orthodox moils involving the mouth, which turned out to spread herpes to infants. And no one seeks to restrict religious education as long as students also receive instruction in secular subjects according to state standards. So take it on.
Sure. Seems like this fellow disagrees. He's welcome to read not only, you know, the article which you read, but a whole lot of briefing and court decisions that I guess he finds it disingenuous. But with respect to the circumcision, which, you know, played out a while ago, there were, you know, a small number of cases that arose after circumcision. Government was not able, you know, in any scientific way to necessarily connect to circumcision, but certainly there was reason to have some concerns. And really, outside of New York City, every county in New York State, you know, came to some agreement with a protocol of testing and whatnot to do it. But it absolutely was a restriction. It couldn't go forward unless there were signed forms by a parent and somebody else. And it certainly would impose a restriction. The person doesn't like the practice. That's his or her prerogative. Many parents do. Chabad, for example, the entire Chabad movement, every Chabad mole, you know, interprets the requirement for circumcision to include this practice. This really was the first instance of a regulation of circumcision ever in the United States. So it was a big deal. It would have an impact. And you know, the small number of cases, and again, I'm not here to minimize any, you know, how people have to look at, you know, potential health risks. But the facts were just not there, which is why, I mean, I don't think that, you know, three judges of the Second Circuit, you know, were in the tank for circumcision of a certain way, you know, and were willy-nilly going to ignore health risks. It's just the facts were not there. And the most important point really about the Second Circuit's decision there was it says, well, there were 90 cases of neonatal herpes. The government says that about a dozen of them over a number of years might have been connected to circumcision. Again, their experts said it was biologically plausible, which is, you know, not the strongest form of connection. But in any event, the government says, but the city didn't care at all about the other 80 cases. You know, they weren't investigating, you know, the conduct that led to them and figuring out how to regulate it. Didn't care one whit, and that's what the court said. And I quoted the court in the article. So I think it's just again, if you see no value in it, if you think circumcision is outdated, or this particular practice of circumcision is outdated, and you know, embarrassed by it because, you know, that's not what people should do today, well, then, you know, it's sort of simple to say, let's get rid of it, or let's, you know, regulate it, or let's minimize it. But that's really not, you know, what the First Amendment allows. You get into education, I think it's really just, you know, a whole lot of really misinformation. I mean, I think it's unfortunate, but that, you know, some group of you know, critics of Jewish education have you know, been allowed to select a small group of schools and say this is what Jewish education, you know, is in New York, and it's really ridiculous. But the regulations that New York has enacted and is trying to enforce go well beyond saying teach this or that. Also, you know, they worry not at all about outcomes. It's all about, as with every bureaucracy, it's about inputs. It's about, you know, you have to teach this way. We're dealing currently with a state education department that says it's not enough to say that the kids, you know, are taught, you know, to read and write English, but we have, you know, we want you know, a range of texts. You know, so the government, you know, wants approval of the texts that are used to teach the kids to read English. And honestly, in 2023 New York, there are a lot of, you know, Orthodox Jewish parents who don't want the government to decide the range of texts. The government is getting very involved in the selection hiring of teachers in religious schools. Again, there's a lot of ways to look at, you know, what government should do, but telling schools that we want to approve your range of texts and we want to get involved in the teachers is really something that you know, crosses a line for a lot of parents. And frankly, we're seeing it right across the country, not religious education, right? But you see it in places outside of New York and not involving religion. You see it among public school parents, right? Who say, you know, we want the ability to direct our educations, the education of our children, even in the public school setting. It's you know, I there was an article I read over the weekend by two mothers who said, you know, we're not co-parenting with the government. And that's the way.
Let me stop you. I'll stop you there because there's a question I want to get give to Dahlia. This is an interesting question. It's from Frank Brodsky, who asks, can you comment on the Charlottesville, on how the Charlottesville case impacted what happened on January 6th? He adds, my understanding is that some of the leaders of January 6th were unable to attend in person due to the Charlottesville ruling. But getting beyond the specifics of that question, I think it's really a question about the connection between the bigotries that we saw at play in Charlottesville and then the larger question of the assault on democratic institutions on the 6th of January. So your reflections on that, Dahlia?
I mean, in some sense, this is definitionally Jewish power, because this was a bunch of lawyers dusting off a Reconstruction statute, the KKK Act, that had not been used in decades. It had been used a little bit during the civil rights era, hadn't been used in a long time, and said, hey, this appears to be a statute that says that if you go to a public event with the intention of harassing people on the basis of race or religion, you will be punished. And so in some sense, the answer is those same statutes, both state and federal, were then used to prosecute January 6th defendants, particularly those who were committing, you know, acts of racial violence. And so to me, again, it's both the genius of these lawyers who said there should be a vehicle. Oh, wait, there is. It's just nobody's used it. And they used it successfully. The state version, not the federal, the jury found only on the state cause of action. But to me, the, again, use of it in a way that was so successful that we then saw prosecution of January 6th rioters and insurrectionists using the same kinds of statutes is really, really proof positive that that's the kind of creativity and sort of legal thinking that not only was rewarded with convictions, but should be celebrated and is kind of probative to me of what Jewish power, all out of proportion, again, to what we think of as Jewish power really looks like. And maybe the last thing I'll say about it is, you know, when January 6th happened, my sons who were at Zoom school because it was COVID, both came down from their various bedrooms where they were attending Heschel High School in New York and said, it's happening again. This is happening again to them. Charlottesville 2017 absolutely prefigured January 6th. And I think both of them and an awful lot of people who didn't think the law had the capacity to respond to this were really happy, I think, to learn that, in fact, there is a line of demarcation between pure speech and violence and threats and threats of violence and actual harm. And so I think in some sense, my very Jewish answer is that the through line between Charlottesville 2017 and January 6, 2021, is that it turns out that the legal system does have the capacity to address it. We just have to be creative.
Let me ask you a quick follow-on question, just because I see it here and it's connected. It's from Jeffrey Herf, professor at the University of Maryland and a contributor to Sapir. He writes, in the press, including the New York Times, Washington Post, and NPR, cable news, the story of the neo-Nazi attack in Charlottesville was, as I recall, overwhelmingly one about Confederate statues and white racism. As Dahlia Lithwick examined the press and media examination of the Charlottesville event, and if so, does she agree that the main media story was one about white racism and not about anti-Semitism, despite the chance the Jews will not replace us?
It's such a good question. And I wish, Masua and I thought a lot about it. And in our articles, we sort of flick at the answer to that. I haven't seen a systematic study done of whether the press told it as an anti-Black story or an anti-Semitic story. My recollection, just having been there, was that Blood and Soil and Jews Will Not Replace Us got a lot of airtime in the days around it, but also that the press told the story of the trial as a story of fundamentally a race riot as opposed to a religious riot. I think it's a really superb question why it was that the press coverage, both of August 2017 and of the trial, didn't do a more deft job of telling it as a story of both things happening at the same time.
Do you have a theory?
I think that my very dispiriting theory is that it was easier to understand in the light of the fight around the Confederate monuments as ultimately just an anti-Black rally. And don't forget, there were, you know, cars terrorizing Black neighborhoods in Charlottesville for weeks before, and the Proud Boys who came weeks before, and the Klan, by the way, who also came weeks before. It became just really easy to center it as a story about anti-Black racism. And I also think, again, this was a tiny, tiny, tiny Jewish community in the South that didn't fully, I think, get aired as a story of anti-Semitism because it didn't happen in New York City.
I would add just briefly, speaking as a member of the media, that at least until recently, there was a real blind spot, I think, among people in the media community about the seriousness and severity of anti-Semitism and the fact that it was mounting in many quarters. I think that's changed last couple of years as the numbers have become so alarming. But back in 2018 or 2017, the Charlottesville march, I think people were still had their heads in the sand. Avi, this is a question from Ilana Berlin for you. She says, Avi is talking about the idea of allyship, but it does not sound like there are meaningful steps to build those allies with the evangelical and Muslim communities in New York, even though this sounds like it would be beneficial. Can you please expand on why or why or why not the Orthodox community is attempting to build those bridges?
Sure. I think we attempt to build those bridges because it's necessary, it's useful, and it's important. I think in New York, if one thinks about politics, one gets worried about, whether certain groups bring along, positions on unrelated issues, which could complicate matters as you viewed in New York. I think that's a legitimate, issue for people to think about. If we're worried about, whether it's protecting education or circumcision or worship, you don't necessarily want to bring in, every other issue, which is a hot button issue in New York, which we're not thinking about. It's not our issue. So I think that probably has contributed to the past. And I think what Dalia said earlier, right? Historically, right, the mainstream Jewish organizations in New York, the one that had the loudest voices, the ones who were, turned to by the media for commentary on every issue, were aligned entirely with, not only the liberal, community, but probably, the left wing part of the liberal community. And, I think they weren't looking to religious Jews or other religious people, for allyship in New York, as the Orthodox community has developed, its own infrastructure. We certainly have reached out. One of the early cases, going back, I think, to the late 60s, early 70s, which the Orthodox group that was formed to speak out on and to address legal issues, one of the first cases they took on was on behalf of a, I believe it was a Muslim bus driver, right? So it was an Orthodox Jewish group that wanted to advance the cause of religious rights and employment, and their plaintiff they chose was not Jewish at all. And I think, the Orthodox group has, the Orthodox community has built on that for several decades. There's more that can be done and more that should be done, but certainly we do look, to get together with, whether it's the Catholic community, the Muslim community, and others to try to protect, the cause of religious liberty.
Very briefly, Avi, because we have to go and I want to respect people's time, but this is an important question. I wish I'd got to it a little sooner. Stanley Spatz asks, education has always been central to American citizenship. Does the Orthodox community, especially given the largesse it receives from the state, have an obligation to include more secular civics in its religious schools?
I think, again, there's so much, misinformation about, what goes on in the Jewish community schools. New York, just, there's 450 different Jewish schools in New York, enrolling, about 170,000 students. We're not hierarchical. There's not one or 10 or 20 bodies that sit above them. And so, to have this conversation driven by whether there's a particular small school somewhere that does or doesn't something, is really not the right way to look at it. The story of Orthodox Jewish education in New York is one of tremendous success in terms of, the outcomes of the students, success in terms of the education, the higher education they go on to. I mean, the number of Orthodox Jewish graduates of New York schools who go straight from rabbinical school to Ivy League law schools today, it's incredibly large. You're talking about dozens of students every year who go to Orthodox elementary school, Orthodox high school, Orthodox post-high school, take the LSAT, have a Talmudic degree, and go to Ivy League schools. It happens everywhere, happens every day. And so I think it's really just a misunderstanding in terms of what's taught, and so the argument is not about what's taught. It's really about or how you know, the schools look at their obligation. It's really about government, you know, trying to take control of a system, which, you know, there's not that, I don't, there's not time for this. There's not that much money that comes into the system, you know, either, but that's neither here nor there. I think, you know, I got to say, there was a group up at Columbia that put an amicus brief on one of the cases and actually had a footnote that essentially complained about the high voting rate in the Hasidic community, right? So, which would seem to me that someone's doing a good job, you know, in civics if they're getting people to turn out to vote. But that goes to the, you know, you can't win either way, right? You know, we don't teach civics and we go out to vote. There you have it.
Listen, I wish I could get to more questions, and I apologize to so many of the lovely people attending this who whose questions I didn't get to. I really want to thank both of you for coming together from very different perspectives, but with a common set of concerns about Jewish vulnerability, Jewish power, perceptions of power, and how we create conditions for a thriving Jewish future, which is what Sapir's organizing principle. And hearing from a real variety of voices and bringing those voices together, agree or disagree, I think is part of the answer. So thank you both. Thank you everyone so much for being a part of this.